and as far as possible, try to make one of the convocation periods refer to ministry among the blacks. And that's our topic today. And I feel rather strongly that our sense of history evaporates at times, and there are names and events that we ought to know about if we're going to be Missouri Synod pastors. I don't know what names like Greensboro would mean to you, or Marmaduke Carter, or Rosa Young, or Peter Hunt, or Joseph Lavallee. These all ought to mean something to you. If you have not read it, one book that you ought to pick up sometime is Roses and Thorns, written by Dr. Rich Dickinson, who works downtown for Synod in recruitment for black ministry and development of ministry among blacks and so on. And it's characterized in the beginning as being a bittersweet story. The history of black missions in the Missouri Synod is a very interesting one. And we thought that we could achieve two things by asking our new second vice president of Synod to be here. We'd like to take our chance to Dr. Lavallee at honoring you for that. We're very grateful. I've been to a number of synodical conventions, but this was one thing Synod did that I was heartily in favor of. You can fill in the rest of that if you want. Oh, me and my big mouth. Anyway, it might interest you to know that Pastor Lavallee, although he's been in the ministry about 44 years, I guess, and has lived through a good share of the 100 and some years, did not become a pastor of the Missouri Synod. He wasn't allowed to until 1944, and he may tell you why. But he signed the Synodical Constitution at that time and became the first black pastor of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Dr. Lavallee is pastor of St. Philip's Lutheran Church in Philadelphia. He and I have known each other for a long time. We worked together in the Eastern District. I think he probably was the first black pastor to be a circuit counselor, and he was in perhaps the hottest corner of the Eastern District. He became a vice president of the Eastern District, has served on synodical committees and commissions, and it was very proper that he should be honored in being elected vice president. Some years ago, the Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield granted him his doctorate, and in this paper, which the Eastern District, they sort of turned handsprings. They put this out, headlines and all, Lavallee named Synod Veep. And they quote some of the things that were said at that time, and I'd like to read a couple of these sentences and then let Dr. Lavallee speak to you. Men everywhere in our church, his DD citation declared, have testified to the dedication, the selfless service, and the pioneer spirit of Brother Lavallee as an ambassador of Christ among the black people. And in Philadelphia, his ministry of reconciliation has been a blessing not only to his congregation, but to the church in the entire area. In the Eastern District of our Synod, among synodical officials, he is well known for his understanding leadership in race relations, as a tireless worker, esteemed and appreciated theologian, bold leader in education and institutions of mercy, and as a knowledgeable churchman. It is our privilege and our honor, Dr. Lavallee, to have you share this hour with us.
Thank you. Good morning. Dr. Schultz, members of the faculty and co-workers and students. With an introduction as has been given, I feel somewhat like the widow who was in the audience for the funeral of her husband. And the minister stood and gave a glowing introduction and many factual things as he knew them or thought he knew them. This man was a loving and providing father, a conscientious and consecrated husband, and many other things. And she was seated there on the front pew together with her children, particularly the oldest son, who was her escort. And she said to him after a while, "Get up there and see if that's your father in the casket." That's the way I feel. Was it an introduction to me or somebody else? I assure you that I'm happy to be here with you and to share with you some of the facts and figures as we know them. We will present them to the best of our ability. There is a hymn that we love to sing. I love to tell the story of Jesus and his love. I think you know it, you know how it goes along. Next to loving to tell the story of Jesus and his love is to tell you of how that love was handed down to the black people, who is part and parcel of the Missouri Senate now, but at the time that it was told, or first told, we're not. It was back in the late 80s, or 1800s, that a group of churchmen, consecrated and conscientious, met in Indiana. And at this meeting, an individual whose name you know, or who has been and still is a very good friend of yours and also mine, Dr. J.O.A. Preuss. His grandfather was in the audience of those who sat discussing the church and its workings and how it could launch out and extend his hand to those who knew not the truth in its purity, the gospel as they had it, so that he felt it was time now to reach out and to work among the American Indians, the blacks or Negroes of the South, and the heathens. And from that it started. Four such senates within the Lutheran Church banded together and started what was known as the Synodical Mission Board, whose specific work was to work among the heathen, the Negroes in the South, and the American Indians. After surveying sections or areas of the South, they decided to settle in Little Rock, Arkansas. And it was in Little Rock, Arkansas that the first Lutheran Sunday school and church had its beginning. I think it was December 2nd, 1877, that the first Sunday school session was held, and then followed by the service. Just how many were in attendance at that service, I do not know, and I haven't been able to find anyone who did know. But as far as Sunday school is concerned, there were two black children that attended this session. And of course, from those two, or from that date on, thousands have come unto the Savior's loving and waiting arms. I am one of those who came after these two. I am a fourth generation Lutheran. My grandfather and mother, on my mother's side, were Lutherans. Then she became a Lutheran. And down the line, and then I came along. My mother was Lutheran, but my father was Catholic. And I think you would remember the words there in Corinthians, the love chapter there. And in that chapter it says, love is thus, love is so, these three. And they say love is blind. Some time ago I was talking to an individual, and his buddy came along, and he said, "You don't know that guy, do you?" I said, "No, I just met him." He said, "You know, we grew up together. We were in the army together, and we were discharged at the same time, and we each went our way. I got married, and several years after marriage, our paths crossed again. And I asked him, 'Have you married, or are you married, or are you going to get married?' He said, 'No,' he said, 'I haven't married yet.' I said, 'What's the matter? Are you afraid?' 'No.' He said, 'Somewhere down the line, I heard that marriage was blind, or that love was blind.' He said, 'Yes, so says the scripture. And I heard that marriage was an institution.' 'Yes, that is true.' Well, he said, 'You see, I don't want to go into anything blind. Since love is blind and marriage is an institution, I don't want to enter that institution blind.' Love in this instance did not know color or religion or what have you, and my mother and father got together. And after a few years of correspondence, they were married. My mother at that time was 17 years old, and my father 23. And my mother still lives. My father went home back in 1959. And on occasions, my 86-year-old mother is still filled with vim and vitality. She still has a sense of humor. And of course, every now and then, I try to increase this humor and what have you. And she accuses me of picking at her, teasing her, what have you. And then when she gets a little bit, out of hand, she showers down on me and says, "Now look, you just remember, you're only 18 years older than I am." And we have a lot of fun. I'm the oldest of seven children, and she boasts of the fact that she has known three men in her lifetime, and I happen to be the second one that she knows, but the first one, my father, and the third one, my brother, have both gone home, and she just can't afford to lose me. And I said, "Oh, Mother, please, don't say that. The Lord's getting at you may strike me," and what have you. So we have a lot of fun. And, of course, we cherish the association and the relationship that exists between us. And oftentimes, we sit down and we reminisce about the church and how it started. My dad, who was Catholic, because of love being blind, he entered the Lutheran Church after three of us had come along, three children, because we took him by the hand and led him to our church, particularly at Christmas time for the Christmas program, for the Easter program, and for the school closing. He learned to know the pastor very well. He was a very likable fellow. And he would like to say that this was his pastor. And he was rather small in stature, like Zacchaeus. And he stood but so high above the pulpit. And he said, "You know, thee. My little pastor likes to let us know that he's there. And when the Spirit gets a hold to him, he just shakes that pulpit. And he says, I know that the Spirit has you. My father wasn't an educated man. He came along in the day when the older people looked upon the children more or less as sources of income, that he could work and what have you. During the winter months or the rainy season, it was all right for them to do nothing. But when the spring came and the work season, then you come out of school and go out into the fields, or then you use your talents for my well-being and welfare. And my father went to the third grade. But there was very little that he learned. Or he could add two and two and come out with five, or 10 and 10 come out with 30. And then he could spell his name, but he couldn't write it. And this little pastor taught him how to read and to write and to figure. And for that, he loved him. And then one day, the pastor preached on the words of, or on the answer of Peter to Jesus, when Jesus asked, whom do men say that I, the Son of Man, am? And they told him, this one says that, and the other one says the other, and so forth and so on. He said, all right, that's fine. But now, whom do you say that I am? And it was Peter, that the spokesman, who said, we believe and we are sure that thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. And that answered something for my father. He had been told ever and on that Peter was the first pope, and that the Catholic bishop or pope was now his direct successor. And of course, my father couldn't accept that altogether. But after this now, after this sermon, he knew that he was on the right track. And he sought more information, and the pastor just voluntarily gave it to him. And one fine day, he went to the Catholic Church, as he had gone before. And in the Catholic Church, you have to pay for your seat. And no one is entitled to sit in that seat but you. But this particular Sunday, my dad was a little late. And there were visitors to the family, and they tagged along to service. So my dad could not get into his seat, and inasmuch as the seats were paid for, he dare not go into someone else's seat. So he went in the back of the church, and there he stooped during the service, and he had his head down like this. Back in those days, you couldn't sleep in the church. The pastor wouldn't call you by name and says, wake up. No. There was one man who walked up and down the aisle with a long pole, and if you were sleeping, he'd tap you on the head. And my mother tells this, that my dad was a proud old rascal, and when he had his Sunday go to meeting on, he didn't want a fly to light on his suit or on him. And that made him angry when this fellow tapped him on the head, who happened to be his first cousin. And he walked out of the church, and the only time that he returned to the church was when there was a funeral, or maybe his family was involved in something. And because of that, now he was alienated to the church, and he came into the Lutheran church. And because he joined the Lutheran church now, his parents disinherited him. They would have nothing to do with him. But thank God, before they died, there was a reconciliation. They came back together. To some extent, this is giving you a little of the background. Now, how Lutheranism came to the little town in which I was born and reared, Mansour, approximately 1,200 inhabitants. You could stand at one end of the town and yell, and they'd hear you at the other end. And someone from the little town went to New Orleans, where Lutheranism had already come. Dr. Schultz mentioned Bakke. It was he that came to New Orleans and spoke about the Lutheran church, and there were blacks among the people that he spoke to, particularly as a gunner. This man was the dog. You know, you need a good hunting dog to track down the things that you're hunting, like squirrels and rabbits, etc. And this man was a good tracker. And the white gunners knew that, and they employed him very much to lead them around where the game was. And so he heard this, and he wanted to know how he could get more of it. And finally, he was told. And this same man now was employed by someone from the north to go down to Mansoura, where I was born and reared, and there to gun on a great uncle's property. And this great uncle was Baptist, of course. And this black man who lived there at my uncle's home during the time that they were there began talking about Lutheranism and what a thing it was, enlightening and informative and what have you. And of course, he found a very diligent, conscientious, consecrated ear in my uncle, and he just fed him everything. And then my uncle said, well, now how can we have something like that here? And in this little community, we were not then, and not too much now, plagued with other religions. The our main church there was Catholic, and next to the Catholic, the Baptist, and then the Lutherans. And there were only three denominations there, Catholic, Baptist, and Lutheran. And he says, now how could we get something like that here? Well, he says, I'll talk with my pastor and tell him of your interest and what have you. And a few weeks later, the pastor contacted his uncle and invited himself there and said, well, I'll be there such and such a time, and if this is not convenient for you, let me know. Sure enough, the man came. And they started services in this uncle's home. And that very house stood until about 6 months ago. And it was condemned finally by the state, and it was torn down. But prior to that, nothing was done. The owners did not permit any refurbishing or adding here or there to it. The only thing that was added to it was paint. They painted the outside. And it was there that the church got started. And it was there that my grandfather and grandmother, whose uncle they were to this young man, became acquainted with the church, and from there the church continued. You might want to know, well, how did you get into the ministry? My pastor, not the one that taught my father how to read and write. I've had only two ministers in my lifetime, and it became a privilege, whether one of joy or sadness, to commit their bodies to the ground. I buried both of them. And the last one, the one that taught my father how to read and write, became a member of my parish in Philadelphia. And I would say to him, and he was a southpaw, and I can remember taking, he'd take that strap and he'd really shower you with it. And I said to him, see now, history repeats itself. And he said, what is that? At one time, you were my pastor, and you let me know that you had authority to strap me because my dad told you, look, this is your child, I put him in your hands, and all I ask of you, from 8:30 in the morning to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he's yours. Spare his hands and his eyes, because I need his eyes to see what I want him to do and his hands to do what I tell him. The rest belongs to you. And of course, I told him then that he literally accepted the assignment that my father gave him. Now I see history repeats itself. Then I was your member. Then I was your child. Now you are my child and you are my member. You remember what you did? We really enjoyed that. The present pastor, that is after this pastor, left, then the other pastor came, and he was rough on rat. He'd whip you at the drop of the hat. And I can remember when I was in the fifth grade, and he had a son who was in the same grade. But his son, as he got the reputation or the name, he was as dumb as Chicken Little when it came to arithmetic. And arithmetic came natural. It was just a crib for me, so to speak. I'd get my math out in a double-quick hurry. And he soon found that out after coming. And he came to me one day and he says, "Look, will you help me with my math?" "Yeah, I'll be glad to. If you will give me some of your lunch." He came to school with bought bread, sandwich, you know, over ham, lettuce, all the works. But I came to school with a cold potato, homemade bread, and a piece of, the name that we gave it at that time, and it was known by that, sow belly, which is salt pork, and it's from the stomach of the pig. And, of course, that wasn't too attractive or appetizing, not as far as his lunch was concerned. So we agreed, if he would give me some of his lunch, I would help him with his math. One day the teacher, and of course the teacher knows what his child in particular can do, or his student. So the teacher wasn't too sure that his son wasn't doing the work, but he knew his capabilities, he knew his ability. So he said to us, "All right, bring up your work, your homework, put it on my desk, and go to the blackboard. No pencil, no paper, no book." And then he called out the problem. And he said, "Now you work this one, and so forth and so on." And the boy made it certain that he would get as near to me as was possible so as to help him with his problem. And the teacher said, "Now look, nobody helps anybody. And if you need help, that's what I'm here for. Now, if it won't be 2-1, am I catch helping the other?" Oh, good night, that put the bite on it. So he was there and he copied the problem down as the teacher told him. And then when he says, "All right, go to work now," the boy said, "Well, I didn't hear no man." Of course, I didn't hear him. I was getting away from him as far as I could. Finally, the class went back to its seat having done its work. But the young man still stood there fumbling around trying to do this, trying to... And then his father looked on his paper and he says, "Say..." He said, "That same problem is worked correctly here on your paper, but you seemingly can't get started here. What's wrong?" "Nothing." And he's crying by this time. So he said, "Well, young man, I'm going to help you. But he says, it's going to cost you something." He went out in the yard. They were building a sacristy, adding a sacristy to the church. And they had these little plaster laths about so wide. And he got one about so long. And each time he told him, "Well, 2 and 2 are 4. And this subtracted from that is such and such." And he would track him. And he was hitting him right across the shoulders and the back. And by this time now, blood was oozing from his back because the skin had been broken. So I went home and I told my mother in the afternoon, "Guess what happened today?" She said, "I have no idea." And I waited for her to say, "Well, what did happen?" She never did. And I told her now what happened. And I expected her to say, "Well, he had better not do that to you. He'll have me to reckon with." No, she didn't say that. And I waited for her answer. She was a little slow coming through, but she did. And she said, "I suppose he deserved it." Mm-mm. I didn't expect her to say that. I expected her to say, "Well, now, if he does that to you, he's going to have to reckon with me." Well, what a disappointment in that she said, "Well, I suppose he deserved it." Well, I went on out now. I went into my room and changed clothes and got in work clothes and went out and did my work. And then while I was out there working, I said, "Well, now, how can I get her to commit herself?" And I thought and I thought, uh-huh. When I came back in, "Well, Mother, if he did this to his own child, what would he do to me?" Again, she was a little slow, I felt, in giving an answer. And I expected her to say, "He'd better not do that to you." And then after a while, she said, "Well," after I asked her, "Well, what would he do to me?" "I suppose he'll kill you." And it was this pastor who confirmed me. And now, after confirmation, a pastor from California, one of the seniors or the first missionaries in the blacks, the black man, Reverend Mike David, and my pastor now were very good friends. And Pastor Mike David was tall fella, while this pastor was a little scrumpy. And he was known as Jeff. No, he was known as Mutt. And the tall pastor as Jeff. Mutt and Jeff, they called themselves. And every year he would spend a part of his vacation with Mutt. And of course, Mutt was in the farming area, and the people were on the farm, and the visitor would come, and he'd work with the people. If they were picking cotton, he'd pick cotton. If they were pulling corn, he'd pull corn. So don't stop working, and he would walk along with them. And finally, he would leave, and he said, "All right, see you in church tonight." He was a good preacher. Went to church that particular night. It was a little cool for that time of year, and there was a fire in the fireplace. Came back home, and I was sitting in my little chair there in front of the fireplace. And I said to my mother and father, and there was no conversation, and out of a clear blue, I said to them, "One day, I would like to be a pastor, a preacher, like Reverend Mack." My mother said nothing, nor did my father, and they looked at each other. And that's all that was said or done. I finished getting ready for bed and retired. And after that, I mean, that thought was uppermost in my mind. And I still remember, after 50-odd years, the sermon that he preached that night. And it was the account of David and Absalom. And I can see him, and he was quite dramatic. I can see him walking out of the pulpit, and he had said, well, there was David sitting on the wall waiting for the word as to how Absalom fared in this war against his father and what have you, and how he was crying, and he had a white handkerchief, and he was mopping his eyes as though he was crying. And I said, "I'd like to preach like him." And we had the pleasure of having him speak to chapel, as I'm speaking here to you, in the early part of 1937. I graduated in May, and it was then that I told him he was my inspiration. It was then that I told him he was the one that had planted the seed for me to become a pastor or to enter school, seminary, and study for a pastor. And he says, "God bless you, my boy." And I'm told by those who knew Reverend Mike Davis, who were parishioners of his, and I preached in his church a number of times in California, that if we draw a curtain before the pulpit or put you behind that curtain, we certainly would not be able to tell that it was not our now sainted pastor, Mike Davis, just like him. And you have his gestures, your mannerisms, and what have you. That's how I, so to speak, got the seed planted into me. And in 1928, maybe you will have opportunity to hear him if you haven't, Dr. DeWitt Robinson. He was then a senior at Greensboro, North Carolina. Dr. Schultz mentioned Greensboro. And he was drafted to come down to Mansour and teach the eighth grade. Luther College was to open in New Orleans that fall, but for some reason it was not open. They put it on a money shortage. And he taught me, and he tells everybody now, he's just a few years older than I am, that he was my teacher. He taught that one term. But then in 1929, I left Mansour and came to New Orleans. Graduated from the school. And it seemed as though all the way along, or in my education, that every school that I went to has closed. and with open arms back in 1978, I think it was, or 79, we became, those who graduated from Emmanuel became honorary members of Concordia Seminary, and I have a certificate showing that. The school that I attended, the parochial school, St. Paul in Mansoura, the same Dr. Robinson, when he was a student there in the seventh grade, the teacher berated him for something that he had done, and it was his week to fire the stove. And shortly after this scolding, he had to look after the heater, and he went in and he was poking the fire and throwing wood in it and what have you, and then the sparks began to come from the chimney, and it was the shingle roof, and the shingles caught fire, and the church burned down, so we didn't have the church. Then I went to New Orleans, Luther College. That closed after my graduation. Then I went to Southern University. Southern still stands. But the building in which I attended classes, particularly, we had to have one elective as far as vocation was concerned, and I chose tailoring. That has been destroyed. As Dr. Schultz said, in 1972, they conferred on me the honorary degree. That has moved from Springfield to Fort Wayne. Emmanuel Lutheran College has been moved to Selma, or merged with Selma. So I was left without an alma mater, and that's when Concordia opened its arms and received me. Then to move on, I graduated from Greensboro, North Carolina, Emmanuel Lutheran College in 1937. You see, there were three seminaries, Concordia here, Concordia Springfield, which now Fort Wayne, that was for the whites, Greensboro for the blacks, equal but separate. And today, people refer to me, or they think I'm a graduate either of here or Springfield. And I'm neither. I'm from Emmanuel. And those who do not know of Emmanuel say, Emmanuel, is that a Baptist cemetery? Or is that Methodist or what have you? They didn't know that it exists. And a lot of you, and possibly some of you here, don't know that Emmanuel College existed. But it did. And then from there, I went to Selma, Alabama. Again, continuing closing or discontinued and what have you. Really, I was to go to Moline, Illinois. The assignment had been made. And the dean of the student body knew where I was going. But the day of assignment had not come. And I went to the professor, and we were very good friends. I was his errand boy. I did the things that he wanted done. And there was another fellow who worked on special projects with me. And I recall one day he said to me, Yeah, we go down to the farm. Yeah. And we're going to dig a duck pond. Yeah. So he drove us out to the farm. His son really had the farm. But then he was in partnership with him, and they worked together. So he says, yeah, right here we dig the pond. And he pointed out the area, gave us the shovel and the pick, and then he got in his car and he went back. So when he came back, I said to him facetiously, we have dug the pond. He says, yeah, I had to go back to the office. So I said to him, after I knew that the assignments had come through, where do I go, Professor? Now, he says, Joseph, we can't tell you that. He said, the day hasn't come for that. So a few days later, he opened his book with the directives and what have you and laid it on his desk. And I went to class, and he said to me, Joseph, I said, yes, go and look on my desk. There's a book there, and bring it to me. So I did. And, of course, curiosity got the best of me. And I looked on this book that was open, and I saw my name. Oh, well, then I became interested, really. And I looked, And I saw where I was going, and that's as far as I read, and I went on out. So he said, did you get the book? I said, yes, I did, Professor. Here it is. Okay, thank you. And then he looked at me and kind of smiled at his face. Did you see anything else? And I was valedictorian for my class, and I was on the stage now delivering the address, and a telegram boy bobbed his head in the chapel doors, and there was one instructor sitting there at the door, and when he did that, and he saw who he was, he went outside, and he gave him a telegram, and it was a telegram directed to me to report to Alabama immediately, and the 26th of May, 1937, was on a Wednesday. And be prepared to preach two sermons, 11 and 2, at King's Landing and Maplesville. And, of course, I said, then I'm not going. And the campus pastor, who's a cousin of mine and in whose hands my father had placed me, some of the students told him that I was really on the warpath and I wasn't going to Alabama and blah, blah, blah. And he jumped in his car and he came over on the campus and he says, hey, boy, what's going on with you? Nothing. He says, oh, yeah, something's going on. And he raised his voice to nothing. He said, well, what is this I hear about you not going to Alabama? I said, well, I suppose you heard right. I'm not going.
You're not going? Who said so?
And many other things he said. The next night, I was boarding the 9 o'clock train for Selma. I went there to work in the place of one of the pastors who was suffering from an attack of pneumonia. And I stayed there 7 years now, worked in Alabama. And after that, I was called to Philadelphia. And during those 7 years, it was everything but pleasant. I came up in the good old days, as they said. I was pastor of six congregations. I preached three times every Sunday, and on the side, I taught school. Each congregation had a parochial school, and the laws in Alabama state that a lady teacher has 3 days off every month, whether she needs them or not. And I taught 20 days every month and pastored six congregations. And now what they have done, superintendent then, who is known as the circuit counselor today, when I left, he said, whom will I get to replace you that will step in your shoes and do what you are doing? Oh, I said, anyone who wears a number 12 shoe. He says, yes, that's easy, isn't it? And I came to Philadelphia. Believe me, I went through the mill. I'll never forget it. About 4 o'clock in the morning, this is one of the experiences, one of my members tapped on my window, and he had heard that they were going to kill me that night. I was in this little place for services, and the Ku Klux Klan would be on my agenda for that night, or I would be on their agenda. So he said, Pastor, please don't come. Please don't come for services tonight. I think that was the first time that I used Luther's words, applied them to me as such. Though there be as many Klansmen as there are shingles on the roof, I'll be there at the usual hour, and I expect you to be there. And I did. And so were the Ku Klux. They were there. Windows were open, and there they stood at attention, and they latched on to every word that I spoke. The word had got out that I was teaching the black people not to obey their masters and to rise up against them and what have you. And now they were determined, if that's what I was teaching them, to get me out of there. Believe me, it wasn't a pleasant feeling to stand there knowing that they were out there, because I could see them. And those gruesome regalias that they had on, you know, the white sheets and
Just the eyelids and didn't know who it was out there. Everything that I did, as I said, they latched on to it. And then when the service was over, collection time came, and they passed the hat, just as the baskets were being passed in the church. And, of course, the ushers come up with the offerings, and so did two of them come to the door, and as the men walked up with the plate, so did they, instead of having two people up there at full. And they made it their business to sandwich the two men in between them. The Klansmen stood at the end, and the men, of course, at the time, at the appropriate time, went back to their seats, but the Klansmen remained. I said, now what next? And I stood there in fear and trepidation, but then these words were my comfort. If God be for you, who can be against you? After I had offered the prayer and they stood at attention, whether they were praying along or they were just standing there hearing what I was saying, I don't know. But then after the prayer, then the Lord's Prayer, and it was time now for the benediction, just before I pronounced the benediction, it said, and you're not known by reverend or doctor or what have you. It's either uncle or your first name or a corruption, parson. They said to me, parson? Yes. As long as you teach these niggers what you taught tonight, we're with you. But woe be to you if you teach anything different. And then they walked up. I breathed a sigh of relief that they didn't pull me out. And the members were sitting there on eggs, so to speak, or pins and needles. And one of the members was heard to say afterward, well, I'll be. Because she was the one that heard the word, and they put it where she could get it because she worked for some of those people there. And she was the one that sent this elder to tell me what was going on. She said, you can't pay attention to what you hear. And the fellow that put the word out that following Sunday, he drove me to the church. I was driving a Ford car, and one of the weaknesses of the Ford, or one of the flies in the ointment, as far as the Ford car was concerned, the starter would lock on you, and you had to shake it back and forth to unlock it. But I shook it and shook it. He says, I'm not going to unlock this morning. And this congregation was 3 miles from me, so I started out walking. And thundering down the highway, we heard a car, and I looked back, hoping that whoever it was knew me and would stop. He did. He did know me, and he did stop. And he said to me, Parson, I suppose your people are waiting for you. What's happening? You're walking. I said, well, Mr. A.G., my car locked on me, and I can't get it loose, so I started walking. He said, hop in. Now, up to about 2 miles from the church, it was blacktop. But the rest of the way to the church was nothing but red clay and mud. And it had rained something terrible the day before. And it was really muddy. And he took that highway and he was going slipping and sliding. And he drove me right into the yard and turned around. And I said, how much do I owe you, Mr. A.G.? He said, nothing. Not a thing. All I ask you, if and when you see me or a member of my family with similar troubles, all I ask is for your help. He says, I'll see you. He jumped, started his car and went on. And another member was sitting at the window and heard what he said. She said, well, I'll be. I'll be. You can't go by the things that you hear. Well, I was there for 7 years, and I almost got into it from another standpoint. There was a little doe in the churchyard. And I said, wow. Boy, I'll have some venison after a while. And I didn't know what to say to the little doe. I didn't know what to do to capture him. And I said this and the other, popping my fingers and trying to lure him to me. Finally, he did come to my hand. And then I had taken a rope out of my trunk, which I carried to be pulled out of a mud hole on occasion. And I had taken this rope out of the trunk and had it there, and I was going to tie this little doe, and I did. after a while, and I said to one of the men who came a little bit earlier, I said, "Man, look what I have tied over there to the tree." He looked. He says, "If you don't turn Mr. A.G.'s deer loose, he's going to get you." Needless to say, I was there for 7 years, and I enjoyed it. I worked hard. It wasn't the easiest thing. And now to move on, I was, as they say, the first black man or pastor to pastor St. Philip's Lutheran Church. My predecessors were white. Trumpold and Amp. Pastor Arm still lives, and it was a joyful experience. It was heart-moving here back in June to deliver the sermon at his celebration of 50 years in the ministry. He was pastor of St. Philip's. He's my immediate predecessor. And some of the members now still remember him and his pastorate. And I said to them when I received the invitation that this incident was going to happen and what have you. And they immediately said, "Well, Pastor, can we go along with you?" I said, "Why not?" And they chartered a bus, a 43-passenger bus, and they accompanied me to Washington. I had to fly down because I wouldn't trust the bus being there on time, and since I was the chief man on the totem pole, I said, I can't have them waiting for me. So I decided at the last minute to fly down, and I flew down. But this was a complete surprise to him, as well as the congregation. Only the pastor knew that there was a busload of people coming. And I had informed my people, "Now look, I'm going to extend congratulations and what have you to Pastor Amp in the introduction of my sermon." And when I say, not only do the people here and myself and others join you today in giving praise and thanksgiving to the Lord of the church, but also former members of yours in Philadelphia, members of St. Philip's, and they were instructed, "Now when I say that, you stand." And 43 people stood. And Reverend Amp was sitting in the front, and he looked back, and he didn't know what to make of it. And of course, he's lost his hair, only that I haven't lost mine. And even the top of his head was red. His face was red, and tears were ready to flow, and what have you. And that was the whole talk. I don't know that much of my sermon got through, thinking about what happened back there. So I came to Philadelphia in 1943 as the first black pastor, and people from everywhere in the city, Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterians in particular, were there at the service. The church at that time seated comfortably 180 people, and possibly you could get another 100 in the undercroft. About 280 or 300 people attended the services, some on the outside, some standing. And then I was single when I went to Philadelphia. I was ready to get married, but now changing places and what have you, I didn't know what to expect or what I would find. When I went to Alabama, my salary was $35. No, my salary was $25 because I wasn't ordained. When I became ordained, then I got $10 raised and brought it up to $35. Back in that day, and I don't want to put any ideas in anyone's head, you were supposed to have X number of books in your library. And if you didn't have the money to pay for these, the seminary would advance you what money you needed. And of course, I didn't have that money. I worked my way through school. I didn't have a scholarship and what have you. I carried papers, and I painted, and I drove a cab, and I worked for the matron. I drove for her in off time, and she would give me something for that. And so they loaned me what monies I need. I had a lot of books. Several of the fellows dropped out, theological students, and I got what books they had that I didn't have. So I didn't need as many books as that one who was just starting. And now they loaned you this money, or advanced this money to the bookstore on this premise, that you would pay back the loan by $5 a month. All right, I paid $5 a month, so I didn't see $5 of my check, or salary, monthly. Then I lived in the parsonage, and they charged me $5 to live there, so I was minus $10 now. And when I became ordained, that was the $10 raise that I got. But prior to that, I saw only $15 of my salary, and I couldn't support a wife on that. So I decided I wouldn't get married. And now when I went to Philadelphia, my salary was increased to $90 a month, and I couldn't support a wife on that, so I remained there single. But then after a while, I did marry. And the man that was the circuit counselor, he was, as I accused him and told him, that he was the devil without horns and tail. I have a sister that lives in New York, and she was recently married before I got there, and she was a member of his congregation, and he had her take her wedding band off and just keep the engagement ring on. And she attended the installation services, and they had it arranged, and she was now this prospective wife and what have you, and she made it her business to put her arm in mine and to show this ring. This engagement ring, and several of the good ladies said, "I thought they said he was single and unoccupied." And several of these ladies, they were then single, are still in my congregation, and of course that's a standing joke. Nobody knows what it means other than myself and them when I say, "I thought he was single and unoccupied or engaged," and what have you. But after a while, going got rough. I met situations and had to take on situations, obligations that I had not before. It's not the same as pastoring a country congregation as it is a city congregation. And so these situations confronted me, and we rushed into them. By God's grace, I made it, as we say, and I'm there much too long, and certainly would not recommend this to you, prospective pastors of ours. I'm there 38 years. I can't go back and repeat some of the sermons that I use. As I say, I can't go back to the barnyard, because some of them have what this young man over here has, a tape recorder, and they've taped my sermons. And some of them are secretaries, and they take shorthand, and they know what I've said. And they seem to remember much too much as far as I'm concerned. And I'm always conscious. Sometimes when I'm on the road, I have to go back. And they said, "Pastor, that was a very fine repeat that you had this morning." I finally got married, and never forget it. In carrying the bride over the threshold, you know, I remember that, and some of them took pictures of it, and every now and then flashed those. But my wife went home on the 24th day of October, 1968, and I've chosen not to remarry, but just to stand there. So I was the first black pastor of St. Philip's, and I'm the first, as Dr. Schultz said, the first black man to enter the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. When I became a pastor, I wasn't permitted to join the Lutheran Church Missouri. I was a member of the Synodical Conference. These four synods banded together and became part and parcel of the Missouri Synod, but yet not Missouri Synod. Missouri Synod was in it, but then there was the Wisconsin Synod, the Norwegian, and the Slovak. And this made up that Synodical Conference, and we were under that mission board. That mission board was over us and said what we should do and what we should not do. You will receive a call when you go into the ministry, and so forth and so on. I didn't receive a call. The young man came with a telegram, which was an assignment, and this was confirmed. And I'm sorry I didn't bring it along, that you would see what this assignment looked like. It was a document written up and what have you. Call into the service of the Synodical Conference, which means when they got ready to move me to another place, Then they moved me. I didn't have to consider the call and say, I am going and I'm not going. But as of 1946, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, so to speak, took over and made it possible for the black churches or members of the synodical conference to enter the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod by the regular process. You become a member of the district, and you're now a member of the Missouri Synod. I was in Philadelphia now, and I didn't know anything about that. But one pastor, who was also unmarried, was going to the district convention, the Eastern District, and he says, look, you're not doing anything, and you need a little rest. Why not accompany me to the district convention? I said, man, I have no business over there. I'm not a part of that. Oh, he says, come on. So he talked me into riding up to Buffalo or Camp Pioneer, which is just outside of Buffalo. It was the Lutheran layman's camp. And there we sent in Dr. Carl, was it Carl Benke? Was the president of the district at this time, and he had the opening address and what have you. And then after that, we sat and he says, now, all of you new workers, pastors and teachers and what have you, come on up here and sign the Constitution. So I sat. I knew that didn't apply to me because I wasn't a member of the district and the like. So this fellow who was sitting beside me says, what are you doing sitting here? Didn't you hear what the president said? I said, that doesn't apply to me. He says, man, get on up there and sign the Constitution. So that's what I did. I went up there and signed my name along with the rest of them. And several days later, I got a letter welcoming to the Eastern District and what. And I still didn't know what this all meant. And I was then a member of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. My congregation was the first black church to become a member, 1947. December, it made application. Dr. Carl Kurth was the executive secretary, and he was in services that morning, and one of the things, I don't know that they did it purposely, but it happened that way. He was in services that morning, but he called about 9:30 in the morning, services beginning at 11 o'clock, that he was downtown at the hotel, and he was planning to attend my services. I said, fine, come on. And, of course, I invited him to the pulpit. Do you want to preach the sermon that morning? He said, no, I came to worship, right? But we concluded, and you know, you always think you put the worst construction on a thing. And he wanted to see if I was prepared. But it just so happened that I was prepared. I had my sermon, and I informed him of that. I said, I have my sermon. It's not that I want to get out of preaching, but I want to extend you the courtesy of such. And, of course, after the services, maybe I said the wrong thing. I thought about it afterwards. I announced his presence and what have you, and I said to the congregation, not knowing this, that undoubtedly Dr. Kurth has something special he wants to say to you, because he called me about 9:30 this morning to say that he was here. And so at this time, we will give Dr. Kurth the opportunity to say what he has to say to you. And, of course, he blushed and what have you. And apologetically, he said, I have nothing special to say. I happen to be in the city, and I wanted to worship with you, and so forth. But he never did that thereafter. He always let me know a day or so before he got there. And, well, that after that visit, then we became members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. In 1966... prior to that, 1962, I became the first circuit counselor. And my becoming the first circuit counselor, I was next in line as far as seniority was concerned. The circuit counselor accepted a call out of the district. And since I was next in line, then I was appointed his successor. And in 1966, I became the first black vice president of any synodical district and remained such until 1975, at which time I had to step down because things had changed. You could serve two consecutive terms, and then you had to step down, and you could replace yourself after this term that you stepped down. I was then elected circuit counselor again, And I was elected circuit counselor then and remained such until 1966, after which now I was elected vice president. That's when I stepped down for this term. And then in 1977, I was re-elected vice president, and now I had to surrender it after I was elected vice president of Senate. So I surrendered that Monday, 2 weeks ago. I'm no longer vice president of the Eastern District, but now Sonatico Contra. So I've given you that as a background, so to speak, of when things happen. Now, maybe you want to ask a question or so. I hope I haven't disappointed Dr. Schultz or the rest of you by roaming. And they told me not to prepare a manuscript, but I'm doubting Thomas here and there. So I did prepare a manuscript so that if I had to go another way, I would be prepared. I didn't want it to happen, as one young man in our seminary said, unprepared as I am, and then his mouth opened and he couldn't close it.
We don't do anything like that around here, I
sure. I didn't think so.
Are there any questions? I have deeply appreciated your approach, Dr. Lavallee. I think it's this kind of human story that we need to know. There are statistics, and I think the title of Dr. Dickinson's book explains it. He says how that title came about, that one time they had a meeting of some black clergy, and they were talking about the history of the black movement in our synod, and Dr. Peter Hunt said, "It ain't been a bed of roses." And someone else said, "Yes, it has been a bed of roses, but they forgot to take the thorns off." And hence the title, Roses and Thorns. And he has many of the statistics and whatnot. But I think we realize it's been a struggle. And I think Dr. Lavallee's approach to this, good-humored, always willing to accept what the Lord has given you, a great reconciler, and above all, a great pastor. Yeah, Bob?
Yeah.
The first Sunday, which is Father's Day, that this was launched, it went over fairly well. The second year, or the second Father's Day, a little better than the first. But then the third year, it has started downward.
This is the third year?
Yes. And I don't think it is going over too well. Some have put it to not enough publicity. Others have said, well, they give for this and they give for the other, and now they've added one more giving day, and it's beginning to hurt a little. Those are the reasons that have been given. I must plead innocence. I don't know what the response was the last day. I know in my congregation, the second time it went over big. But then there wasn't as much enthusiasm after that as it was to begin with.
Yeah, what was the fund used for?
Actually, for the scholarship fund, we went on record of establishing a scholarship fund. And out of this fund, we would now to encourage recruit boys and men for the black ministry. And our goal is 150 over a 10-year period. We are well on our way. At one time, we were down to 37 black men over the 100-year period. We celebrated the centennial of 100 years of work among the black people in 1977 at Dallas. And of course, since then we've gotten boys and girls too not for the ministry of the girls, but for full-time work in the church as deaconesses or teachers in particular. And it has increased, and now we're running over, so to speak. We got more in that short period of time than we expected. From my congregation, not because of that, there are about 9 workers that have come. There are already 4 pastors, Howard Ford, some of you know, Dr. Ford at Chicago, Pastor Allen in Chicago with the deaf people, and Jay McDaniels at New York. They have come from my congregation, and also one parochial school teacher, Ms. Hurd, Carol Hurd, and now we have her sister that is at Bronxville. We have another student at Fort Wayne, Timothy Green, and Dr. Holmes came by way of colloquy. He's down in Baton Rouge now. He was installed just a few months ago. So we have now, we are well on our way of recruiting those 150 pastors. And the monies that came in from the Father's Day offering, plus the monies that came in, the special offering, the centennial offering, has been placed into this fund. But the cost as of now has, so to speak, eaten up the monies that have come in. And we are really in the red. We are indebted to Senate for some monies for education now of these pastors.
You might mention, Dr. Lavallee, we put a nice, handsome vicar in your congregation, and he walked off with your daughter.
Yeah.
Elmer Marshall.
Some
Elmer
of you
Marshall.
Might know him.
Yeah, Jimmy, you're from Elmer's congregation, aren't you?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he vicared for me, and actually, he was just a happy-go-lucky young man as far as the ladies were concerned. And there was a fine crop of young people in the congregation, and he worked with them. And they would gather there, the parsonage. And one thing, and he still hasn't learned that, he wouldn't put his keys in his pocket, his car keys and house keys. And he'd just lay them wherever there was space for them. And they would hide his keys. He was looking everywhere, and they were getting a big charge out of this. And he'd come to me and said, Pastor, they're hitting my keys, and they won't give them to me. And so I say, all right, girls, come on, give them your keys. And all at the same time now, he was looking at my daughter. And one day he came back from school, I think around Christmas time, and he said to me, Pastor, I said, yeah, I have something I want to talk with you about. So I find, and be it furthest from my mind, that this is what he wanted to talk with. So I said, well, shall we go into my study? He said, no, I'd rather go to the church. Okay. So we went over to the church, and there we entered the office, and he said, Pastor, I said, yes, you know that it comes in the life of everyone that he would take claim his mate. I said, yes. And be it still further from my mind, he was talking about my daughter. I said, yes, and that's a fine thing. I know what it means and so forth and so on. And I talked with him about married life and whatever. And he said, now, the reason I wanted to speak to you specifically about this, he said, I would like to ask for your daughter's hand in marriage. I said, what? It's a good thing we're over here, because I would have pulled out my shotgun. And so he is. He did take my daughter away. And I said, if I'd known that, you certainly would not have vicared here. You would have gone somewhere else. And that happened to be the youngest of 3 children.
Somebody else? Yes, please.
I was wondering if you could let us know what kind of percentage of black churches are being served now by white pastors, and some of the specific challenges to the white pastor in a basically black congregation.
I don't know that I can give you the exact number of white pastors serving black congregations. We have 2 black congregations in Washington, and both congregations are served by white pastors. The greatest number of white pastors serving black congregations, I think you would find in the Southern District. Many of the congregations are served by white pastors, that is, the black congregations. I think, we did have one black pastor in the Southern District, or rather, no, not in the Southern District, but in New Orleans. And now we do not have any black pastors serving there. But Birmingham, Montgomery, now they don't have any there in Pensacola. I think we have one or two in Mobile. They're scattered around. But the greatest concentration is in the Southern District, as far as I know. And then they're scattered throughout. There are 175 congregations that is 100% black or 40%. Or consider a congregation black with 40% membership, as far as the blacks are concerned, to 100%. And there are 175 of those.
Could you also share with us some of the specific challenges for the white pastor and the black church other than the normal pastoral?
I don't know that there is. Say this, that black people are eager for the gospel in its truth and purity. Heretofore, they have been served by ministers, supposedly, and we say that in quotes, who are supposed to have known the truth. I was traveling from Cleveland, Ohio, back to Philadelphia one day, and I wasn't dressed as a minister. I was reading theological magazine, and this fellow looked over and he saw what I was reading, and he said, "Are you by any chance a minister?" And I said, "Why do you ask? Or what gives you the impression that I might be a minister?" "Well," he said, "you just look like a minister." Well, I said, "What is it about me that would say that I am a minister?" He said, "I don't know, but you just look like a minister." And he says, "Are you?" Well, I said, "I'm like George Washington. I have to tell you the truth, yes." And he said, "What faith?" And I said, "Or denomination?" I said, "Lutheran." "Oh," he said, "boy, you got it." I said, "What do you mean I got it?" He said, "The Lutheran Church, as far as I'm concerned," he says, "I'm Baptist." And he said, "I'm a Baptist minister. But the Lutheran Church has it, because it has an educated clergy. While the Baptist, no, you see a vision." And I almost got punched in the mouth by interpreting that vision when I was in Alabama. There was a fellow who really could not read his name if it was in letters as big as this room. And he said he had the vision. And the vision was three letters, G, C, P. And I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Go preach Christ." And after talking with him for a while, I said, "Well, I would interpret that vision differently." He says, "Yeah? How would you interpret it?" I said, "That means go plow corn." And that's when he snapped back, and he was very indignant there. For the most part, that is the type of ministry or minister that the other denominations have to put up with. However, not today as much as in days gone by. Pick up a little overnight bag, and here they would go. Today they hold the Bible in their hands and they walk up and down the streets with it. And I found it into my travels and dealing with the people that they're so appreciative of the gospel. I can recall when I was in Alabama in the sixth congregation, I did have a young man who was vicaring for me. He was at one of the congregations down at Pine Hill, Alabama. And he was one of those guys who couldn't eat pork. And since I wasn't married and lived in the parsonage and there were two bedrooms, then he lived in one of the bedrooms and I in the other. And we had our turns in cooking. He would cook one week and I'd cook one week. And I was very fond of pork. But he couldn't eat it because something happened to him when he ate it. And I snuck in a little pork in a mixture of beef and pork. And as soon as it hit his stomach, it kicked on him, sick back, and he was as sick as could be. And we had arranged the services. He would take three services, and I would take the other three, and we would have services on this Christmas day, but just one car. I'd drop him off at this place and go to the next place, while now he would take the car and go to another place and drop me off, and we had the service. Then I had to take all six of the services. And it rained terribly much that Christmas Eve. But we had arranged one service, or rearranged the services. My first service was at 4 o'clock in the morning. And the children's program was connected with it. At 4 o'clock, I was in a mud hole on my way to the church. And the members knew that if I said 4 o'clock, I meant 4 o'clock. And when 4 o'clock came, they said, the pastor's in a mud hole somewhere. And one member had what was known as the mud car, and that was a T-model Ford. And they jumped in his T-model Ford and tracking me down, and sure enough, they found me in this mud hole. And by this time, I had blown one of the valves, and I just stopped, and there I sat. So they got there and pulled me out of the mud hole and pulled me on to the church, and we went on with the service. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, the children are there and a congregation that filled the church. It was jammed and packed. And now I borrowed the mud car and went on to the other congregation we had to have services in. So they're appreciative of the gospel. And in my concluding remark, this is what I want to bring out, the beauty of the gospel ministry, based on the words of Isaiah there in the 52nd chapter the 7th verse. I don't know whether that asks you a question or not, but it is a challenge. If you really want to see the beauty of the ministry and the appreciation based on that hymn, I love to tell the story of Jesus and his love. The young man over here, his grandmother, is a former member of mine, Jimmy over here, and she still shows her appreciation for the gospel. It doesn't make any difference what time. And whenever she sees me, where my son-in-law is pastor, she said, "Now, hands off, I know you, I know you, and if we're not doing right, you're going to take him away." And of course, he had trouble with his car, and she had the pickup truck. And he was driving this pickup truck while his car was being repaired. And I said, "The idea to have your pastor riding around in this, I'm going to take him away from you. Don't do that. Don't do that. His car is broken down, but we're going to get him a car, isn't he?" I said, "No, no, no, no." Oh, that's right, yeah, yeah. Well, Elmer didn't make the difference. He said, "You be sure and tell Jimmy when you get there." That's why, well, it's the one that said through it. Yeah, he told me to take him behind the woodshed. Oh, okay. All right. Thank you for clearing it up.
Okay, any other questions? I'd like to express our deepest appreciation. I know you do a lot of traveling and you've got a large church to handle. Maybe we could conclude this by calling attention to the Black Centennial motto, deliberately designed to be ambiguous, and yet it gives us all something to think about. It was not "we shall overcome," but rather there's a little flag on there that says "into all the world," and it says "we have come," and they deliberately left it ambiguous. You can make of that with what you will. I think one of the greatest things is that despite frequent neglect, some downright stupid decisions made at times, and as you look back over these 100 years, that we have an extremely blessed and loyal group of our Black brothers and sisters, many of whom are, as far as the lay people, are moving into some of our white congregations, so that we have not only 175 congregations with our Black brothers and sisters in them, but you draw the line somewhere. If they're 40%, they belong to the Black Caucus. But we're grateful for the loyalty and the dedicated and sanctified way in which many who remember days long ago when things didn't go so well have continued with us with forgiving hearts and with an enthusiasm for the gospel that is unabated. And Dr. Lavallee, we know that you have, even though you don't like all these pretty words, that you have indeed been used by God. So you can stay humble, but your Lord has made you a powerful factor in this. Okay?
We thank you and appreciate the opportunity. And I would like to leave this for your consideration, this passage of scripture that is found in Psalms 137, which to some extent I feel akin to our problems that we've had. But as you have rightly said, we haven't overcome altogether, but we are sincere in our belief and confident that we shall overcome, if not here, at least there. The children of Israel, you know their history, you know the troubles that they had, and what have you. And it is akin, as I say, to our problems or our problems to him. And it is beautifully described. And you can't help but have tears well up in your eyes as you read the history of the children of Israel as they give it when they were back in Egypt. The 137th Psalm. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there they that carried us away captive required of us a song, and they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy, remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem, who said, raise it, even to the foundation thereof, O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed. Happy shall he be that rewardeth thee as thou hast served us. Happy shall he be that thinketh and dasheth thy little ones against the stone. By the rivers of water. We have not given up, and we're not going to give up regardless of the struggle. Yes, it has been hard. It has been rough and tough. But in many instances, some of us have had and do have the skin of a rhinoceros and the patience of Job. And we think of these words too, as in the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah, particularly the seventh verse, that we were oppressed and we were afflicted. But then the beauty of that gospel, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel. And it is this gospel message. We know that the devil is at the bottom of it. Flip Wilson has to say, the devil made you do that. And we don't think of the person as such doing it, but that the devil using the person to carry out his wicked plans and the lie.